Welcome. This is Real Healing, Real Awakening with Phil Golding.
Healing, Real Awakening. This seventh episode is called Meditation, the Path of Conscious Awareness. And this is part one of a two-part series. In this first program, I will be dealing with the underlying principles and purposes of meditation. The point of this is to give you insight as to why meditation is so important for healing and awakening, for enhancing your ability to take charge of your mind. And in this second program of this two-part series, I will be taking you through some actual meditation processes that will give you a step-by-step guide into meditation and a number of meditation approaches that can be used at different times and for different reasons. For example, deepening your clarity on the fundamental principles of life. Also, for healing any painful emotions and for bringing peace to your mind. Another purpose that I will be dealing with is self-empowerment, building your self-esteem, and being able to enhance your ability to create the life that you want. I hope you benefited from a deeper look into the fundamental principles of the process of healing and self-realization that we embarked on in episode 5, The Power of Love, and episode 6, Taking Charge of Your Life. If you have been listening to the previous shows, you would be very aware by now of the importance of the fundamental principles of unconditional love and total personal responsibility, and that the power to heal, change, to transform your life into a life that you would consciously want for yourself rests in your willingness to accept full responsibility to love yourself unconditionally. In other words, take full care of your own human mind, which is the foundation of your entire life. We must learn to take full conscious command of our mind because everything that we experience comes through the mind to our consciousness. Information reaches the mind via our senses, such as touch, smell, or hearing. Our senses are a passive physical instrument, just like if I held out a microphone, that microphone is like my ears, or if I held up a pair of binoculars, those binoculars are like my eyes. But the mind is a processor. Like a computer, it receives the information and stores that information onto programs that have already been set up in the mind. Now, these programs in the mind are anything but passive. They have a tendency to take this information and then distort it, color it, layer things onto it, depending on what we fear or what we may desire. Consciousness, on the other hand, is like the operator of the computer. If the computer operator is not skilled at understanding what computers are about, in other words, understanding the nature of the human mind, then the mind is likely to be in charge of the operator. It is likely to be operating on automatic routines, on programs, on habits, on old conditioning, which can be a real problem. The problem lies in the fact that most of these programs were created when we were children, with children's vulnerabilities, perceptions, and limited reasoning. Now, if the operator of this computer, of this human mind, is unaware of this fact, it is still taking for granted that these old programs are the only means to processing information, even now that we're an adult, then this information is simply not going to be processed correctly. We are, in fact, going to receive a very distorted picture of life. We may be living in an adult's body, doing adult things such as raising children and earning a living, but we may be seeing life through the perceptions of a powerless, vulnerable, and confused child. Our perceptions, therefore, are driven by these programs, which is our old conditioning, either positive or negative, which constitutes our beliefs. And usually these beliefs have been so long a part of our experience, our existence, that we're not even aware that we have them. We just take it for granted that that's the way things are. But in fact, it's the way we believe things are. If we are running programs in our mind, beliefs in other words, such as, other people are responsible for my choices, or it is the role of other people to make me happy, or other people make me really angry, then my ability to take conscious charge of my life is going to be very limited indeed. These beliefs are understandable and quite natural in children, who are rightly dependent on others to take care of them, but it is not appropriate for an adult. For an adult to be able to shoulder adult responsibilities in an appropriate way, then that adult must know how to emotionally stand on their own two feet. They must know how to take responsibility for their own decisions in life, have real control over the way they think and feel. The fact that these beliefs, these old habit ways of thinking, sink down below our conscious awareness is one of the real reasons why it is so difficult to change. We don't know how to access these programs. We don't even know that they're there. They are laid down in a part of the mind that is designed to take care of routine ways of thinking and behaving. It is the same part of the mind that enables us to drive our cars very easily without thinking, or to even walk down the street. If we didn't have this part of the mind, our consciousness would be cluttered up with all these sorts of things that it just simply doesn't want to have to think about. We just want to stand up and start walking, for instance. It would be a real inconvenience if we had to read a set of instructions every time we got up that showed us how to put one foot in front of the other. But there is one thing that this level of mind cannot do, and that is tell the difference between reality and illusion. This is why children are so vulnerable, because it is this level of mind that is so dominant in their life. It is consciousness that is able to process and determine the difference between reality and confusion. But in a child, consciousness is still in a process of development. Another major problem when it comes to gaining mastery over our life is our self-esteem, or lack of it. We are afraid of not being seen as worthy, competent adults. Instead of accepting our confusions, accepting our limitations, and doing our best to learn about them and correct them, we instead, because of pride, try to cover them up. We try to deny them, and we try to make other people wrong in order to deflect the attention from our own faults. Lack of awareness, therefore, causes us to be afraid because we don't really know how to change ourselves. We don't know that we can take charge of our life. And we are afraid of being judged and condemned by others, so we try to deny our humanness, which then prevents us again from really looking at ourselves. So a lack of awareness, or confusion if you like, and denial, a sort of ego protection, are two of the main obstacles to gaining awareness, true consciousness, and self-mastery. a way to break out of this denial factor, the defense mechanisms of a vulnerable ego, is through self-acceptance and total personal responsibility. The first two steps of the five-step process for healing, wisdom, and empowerment that I've been telling you about in the first six shows of Real Healing and Real Awakening. It is accepting our humanness. It is accepting that we are the representative of unconditional love to our own human self. We have a right to be human. We have a right to have these programs, to have these confusions. As a child, we did not raise ourselves. We could not control our environment, our circumstances. It's like the handicap system of life. Here we are now as an adult. We're going to run our race, but we can actually control that handicap system. As a part of running that race, we can learn how to lighten our load, lighten the baggage that we carry in our minds. And we do this by forgiving ourselves for having that baggage in the first place. Welcome to the human race. We all have it. The important thing is we can do something about it. So accepting yourself and accepting that you can take full responsibility for your mind and your body and your life in general is an essential thing to come to understand. So let's say you have done that. You have set that intent. You are on the way to learning how to truly love yourself unconditionally and accept responsibility for everything that you think, feel, say and do. And you've been doing this for a while, and you look back and you say to yourself, wow, this has really made a big difference to my life. This has sorted out a lot of my problems. There's so much less conflict and stress. I feel so much better about myself. But there's a lot here that I'm still not getting a grip on. I'm still quite confused. I'm still reacting a lot. There's still ways that I am not living the life the way that I want. And I want to create the life that I want to live. How can I go to the next level? How can I be able to look even deeper into the programmings of my mind? How can I reprogram that mind? How can I really understand the nature of life? What is it that I can do that'll help me do that? And the answer I'm suggesting here is meditation. Meditation is a way to lift the lid off the mind, to be able to become the master of this mind, to be very, very aware of the nature of mind. And you cannot really take command of something that you don't have a good awareness of. How can you work with something you don't see, that you simply don't perceive? Meditation is an essential tool for gaining that awareness, in order for you to be able to then act. I have already dealt with the subject of meditation in step 3, Let Go and Tune In, which is in episode 2, in the 3-part series that introduces the 5-step process for healing, wisdom, and empowerment. But we are going to take a deeper look at meditation now, and to begin with, from the perspective of Buddhism. Meditation is a central feature of Buddhist practice, which has continued on uninterrupted in some part of the world over the last 2,500 years. There is a wealth of knowledge here that Western scholars, Western psychologists and psychiatrists and workers in that field would do very well to take seriously. In my field of transpersonal psychology, meditation is regarded as one of the most powerful tools for awareness and personal change. It would be useful to begin with a bit of background of how Buddhism began. As legend would have it, Buddha grew up in a position of privilege in a royal family in a principality of India at around 600 BC. His name was Siddhartha Gautama. Siddhartha's father, the king of that area, was foretold that Siddhartha would be a great man, either a great king or a great sage. Now the king naturally wanted him to follow in his footsteps and be a king of that area as well. So he tried to shield Siddhartha from all the suffering and hardship that lay in the community in order to not to provoke his compassion and turn him on the path of the sage. He wanted to condition him to be a great ruler instead, but to no avail. As soon as Siddhartha became old enough, he started to make his own way into the community and saw suffering, old age, and death. Perhaps because he started off in a position of privilege, he had a conviction that suffering must be unnecessary. No doubt his conviction went deeper than this, though. It is quite clear that if Buddha or Siddhartha Gautama was a real man, which is likely to be so, he would have had to have been born at a very high stage of consciousness to begin with. He would have been a long way down the track of his soul's journey to ultimate enlightenment. From that moment onwards, Buddha devoted his entire life to finding the answer to suffering and breaking its stranglehold on humanity. Now this is a very important thing to consider. Buddha didn't see people suffering and then conclude that, oh, well, they must need better houses or better pay or let's build better roads. He decided to destroy suffering altogether. There was something in him, there was awareness, a conviction, a knowing that told him that suffering was unnecessary. It was not a reasonable thing to have in a human mind. So this man is going for the ultimate, in the same way that I'm talking about going for unconditional love and total personal responsibility. You're going to get a long way if you aim at a target that high. So off he went on his journey, and he joined the spiritual traditions of the time that renounced everyday life that was dominated by the ego and its mind and the constant needs of the body. He became a wandering ascetic monk. He devoted himself in many practices of self-denial in order to try to break the mind's grip on its various dependencies and fears that keep it tied to suffering. Through these practices, Gautama mastered the art of meditation. And through meditation, he came to realize that these severe self-denial practices were actually weakening him. They were actually self-defeating. They were blocking him from getting to the next step. He realized he was falling into a trap of a hate of human life, of his physical body. This is similar to Christian monks of old when they practiced mortifications. Buddha realized that being attached to anything was going to lead to suffering, but he also realized that having an aversion to anything was also going to lead to suffering. So he discovered what he called the middle way. The power of this realization was enough to enable him to take the next step into full nirvana, or spiritual liberation, where his conscious awareness was able to fully break its grip from the body-mind and position itself as the master of his human self. He was able to realize the full power of his spiritual potential, and therefore gain what we would call superhuman power. And this great power was based in unconditional love and compassion for all beings who were still suffering. With this great power of knowing, the Buddha began to teach all who were willing to listen. And eventually these teachings were formalized and put down in written form. and came to be known as the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. The Four Noble Truths are as follows. The first is the reality of suffering. The second is the nature or cause of suffering. The third is the answer to overcoming suffering. And the fourth is the path of overcoming suffering, which is the Noble Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path consists of 1. Right view, 2. Right intent, 3. Right speech, 4. Right action, 5. Right livelihood, 6. Right effort, 7. Right mindfulness, and 8. Right concentration. Now, I'm not going to go into all of these, but I will be looking at the Four Noble Truths. And it's interesting to note, as I stated in my first show, that right view and right intent of the Noble Eightfold Path, the first two steps, are known as the wisdom steps. And they are really known as the beginning and the end. All the other steps are about practicing, understanding, and mastering those two. And right view equates to unconditional love. And right intent equates to total personal responsibility. So how does all this equate to our everyday modern life in the here and now? Well, the same way the five-step process equates to it, really. We apply it to what is right in front of us, to where we are within our own self. Of course, to reach nirvana or liberation would require an incredibly powerful insight or clarity, powerful enough to be able to smash through all the mind's illusions. Nevertheless, any step toward this awareness is going to make our life much more manageable, much more fulfilling, much more peaceful and joyful.
Open your heart to the wisdom of love and compassion to become a sacred Buddha.
So let's have a look now at the Four Noble Truths as a way to get into the meditation practice. Contemplation is a form of meditation. It is really what you've been doing as you've been listening to this show. So let's begin with some contemplation on the Four Noble Truths as a preliminary to begin our practice. As you would recall, the First Noble Truth is about the reality of suffering. Now, what did Buddha mean by that? He actually discovered that everything in physical life bears the seeds of suffering. Absolutely everything. For instance, he stated that birth is suffering. The act of giving birth is suffering. The act of being born is suffering. And then a baby suffers when the baby is hungry. The baby suffers if he's cold or too hot. Everything is inherent in suffering. If you have a wonderful plate of food in front of you, it's your favorite dish, and you could eat it to your heart's desire. Not only that, the food is just going to keep coming. You've bought the restaurant. You've bought the team. They're going to keep making that dish for you as long as you want. And yet, a week later, you're bored with that dish. Your favorite dish. It was so good. Now you're suffering. How can that be? Not only that, you suffered every time you overate due to having too much of the very thing that you wanted. You work hard, you strive, you save and invest, and finally you buy that grand house, that wonderful house that you've always wanted, full of that opulent furniture and the wonderful swimming pool in the backyard and all that green grass and beautiful gardens and gardeners to tend it all for you, and servants and housemaids and butlers, and on it goes. But inevitably, you will start to take that for granted as well. Or you will be afraid that someone will break in and steal some of your jewelry or one of your rare paintings. The house will need constant maintenance. You may have squabbles amongst your staff. Your children may grow up to be spoiled brats. And your partner, despite all the wealth and comfort, may leave you for somebody else and sue you for millions of dollars in the divorce settlement. And to top it all off, all your investments may go crashing in the stock market. And at this very moment, as I'm laying down this audio show, stock markets are crashing all over the world. Thousands and thousands of people are having this sort of experience. We can't stop there, though. Growing old, that's suffering too. We can't stop growing old, and as we grow old, our body becomes frail, our mind becomes frail, and inevitably, we suffer. Therefore, having something in this material world means there's a chance of losing it. In fact, when you consider old age and death, losing something in the material world is inevitable. Everything that we hold on to will be gone sooner or later. Losing something in material world means you don't have it. So there's always this aspect of impermanence. And this is what Buddha discovered. There is always impermanence in the physical world. There is nothing you can absolutely rely on. Everything is moving and shifting. It's not a very happy story, is it? But then that is life, isn't it? We can't really deny it. When we look at it, face it, that is the inherent nature of this physical world. Didn't Christ say, build your house on rock, not on shifting sand? Wasn't he talking about the same thing? But are these things the cause of suffering? Is impermanence the cause of suffering? The answer is no. All this are the conditions of suffering. The cause of suffering is our attachment to things that are impermanent. And this is the second part of the Four Noble Truths. If you try to hang on to something that is impermanent, if you try to base your self-esteem around it, create your identity around it, inevitably it will go, it will crumble. You will suffer because of that. So Buddha discovered that it isn't the conditions of this world that causes suffering. It's our attachment to it. It's our expecting it to be permanent. It is us expecting it to give us fulfillment, to somehow give us that ultimate sense of safety, security, and satisfaction. Buddha realized this is never going to happen. He in fact observed everybody staying busy, 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 trying to chase that elusive fulfillment in an impermanent world and never succeeding. Isn't this what we're still doing today? Back to that stock market again. So should we just reject it all? Escape somewhere? Drop out? But escape too? To where? Drop out to where? We tried to do that in the 60s. Didn't work. But then if we do that, we're indulging in aversion. We're basically hating something, which Buddha discovered is just the other side of the coin. We're either chasing after it or we're running away from it. Both of them are two extremes. We have to find the middle way. We have to accept what is and work with it. There has to be a way to do that. And Buddha regarded that way as non-attachment. In other words, participate in life, but not be emotionally dependent on it. But how can you do that? How can you not be dependent on anything? What are we going to hang on to? Well, Buddha basically said, nothing. You don't hang on to anything. But you do depend on something. But that something isn't outside yourself. It's not even your body. It's not even your mind. It is your consciousness. And it's more than your consciousness. It's the very principles that are the foundation of the power of that consciousness. Back to right view, right intent, unconditional love, total personal responsibility. In fact, it is just unconditional love, supreme consciousness, absolute total reality. This is what is permanent. He said that hang on to what is permanent. This is what we need to base our self-esteem, our awareness, our consciousness, our beingness around, that which is permanent. So simply step back and consider that. Look at those principles. At what time in human history have those principles not applied? There is no time. They are always applicable. What human being do they not apply to? They apply to everyone, always, and there will be no time when they don't. And it probably goes even beyond that. The five-step process for healing, wisdom, and empowerment is based on those two ultimate laws of consciousness. That is why it works so well. That is why people are able to transform their lives using those principles. It's nothing new. It's nothing any particular difference to Buddhism. It's just a different way of looking at it, which is useful, because we need lots of different angles in order to be able to look inside our own mind. So what Buddha discovered through the power of meditation and the insight that came with that is the power of his own consciousness, and that being a consciousness that is above and beyond all that is impermanent, including his own body and mind. A deep understanding of non-attachment is not an easy thing to achieve, but it's an essential thing if we wish to rise above the suffering and confusion, limitations of our mind. The central feature of meditation is learning to become the observer of our entire experience of life, and in particular of our own mind. That is where we start in meditation. If I can observe myself thinking, if I can observe myself feeling, if I can observe my bodily sensations, then who is doing the observing? The answer, of course, is consciousness. And the power of consciousness is in its ability to observe untouched by the reactions of the mind and the body, whether those reactions are instinctual or conditioned due to our childhood experiences. Within the stillness, the silence, and the tranquility of consciousness of the observer is the full power of the universal life force of unconditional love, its clarity, its wisdom, its power to respond to any given situation in life in the most effective way for that moment. The power of consciousness, therefore, is reduced to the degree that it is lost within the mind, and that it can't separate itself from the blind habits, conditionings, the old programming of the mind. Due to being lost in the mind and its habits, consciousness is unable to see with perspective. It loses its power of choice. It becomes a blind reactor rather than a conscious responder or actor. In a previous show, I used the analogy of a rider and a horse. A rider is given a horse that has been poorly trained, that has many self-defeating habits. But this rider has no choice but to use this horse to carry out certain important duties. He has to work with this horse. He has to gain the skill to be able to take command of this horse and as much as possible to retrain this horse. So the rider is not constantly struggling with this horse in order to perform his duties. In regards to meditation, the horse is the mind, the rider is the observer, is the power of conscious choice. Unfortunately, at this point of time in human history, the average person can't even tell the difference between themselves and the horse. They are not even aware of themselves as someone who can potentially be in charge of this horse. They just regard the horse as themselves. The horse takes them wherever it wants to go. So to begin with, we must be able to differentiate ourselves from our mind. The rider must know he is riding a horse, that he is the rider, not the horse. As a being of conscious awareness, we must know that we have a mind, which is an instrument, a tool, a creature, that we are here to be in command of, in order to achieve our full potential in this life. So the first step in meditation, or conscious awareness even, is to get out of our mind. But this need, this desire, this practice of getting out of our mind is really not that unusual. We're doing it all the time in our society. Isn't that what we're trying to do when we have a few drinks, when we take alcohol, in other words? Isn't that what we try to do when we take drugs such as marijuana, heroin, ecstasy? Isn't that what we're trying to do when we watch a movie or a play? Isn't that what we try to do when we become very proficient in a sport or some sort of an art, such as dancing? Now, some of those practices are really about aversion, such as the abuse of alcohol, for instance, or drugs. If I'm indulging in such a practice, it is quite clear that I don't like my present state of mind. I'm trying to escape from it. Even just social moderate drinking, even this is an aversion, even this is a dislike of my present state of mind. I want to relax. I want to be more at peace. I want to let go. So I have a few drinks, lighten up, loosen up, have some fun. Because my consciousness is not awake enough, because I have not realized my power on that level, I am unable to achieve that state at will. I have to rely on some sort of a substance to intake something in order to achieve that state. As someone who is indulging in that sort of behavior, I am basically trying to escape suffering. What about participating in sport or the arts? Is that just trying to escape suffering? Well, in a way, it is, but only partly. I might be bored and looking for something to do, but that doesn't mean that I should stop doing it, particularly when it comes to sport or the arts. Really, what it is also about is trying to reach my potential. It is trying to express myself in some very profound way. And if I get quite good at it, or very focused in it, whether it is sport or the arts or some other pursuit, I may be able to get into what's called the zone. I get beyond my mind into my conscious awareness, into a higher state of consciousness where everything else seems to fall away and my potential zeroes in, focuses in on that task, and my ability to perform that task increases to a point where sometimes it is seen as superhuman. This is meditation. This is practicing the principles of meditation in an active pursuit. Now, this skill of concentration, awareness, clarity, consciousness can be applied to my entire life, right across the board. I can be in the zone, if you like, all the time. I can be in the zone driving to work. I can be in the zone doing my work. I can be in the zone interacting with my child or my partner. I can be in the zone. I can therefore, in other words, enhance everything in my life by being present, by being conscious, by being aware, and therefore being able to make the highest choice in the moment in regards to what is most appropriate for that moment. That is the power of meditation. In Buddhism, that's called mindfulness. Mindfulness is describing the ability to be consciously aware in each moment and to be able to act from that consciousness, not from blind habit, which is not necessarily appropriate for the moment. Blind habit is inevitably created at some past point. It might be useful now, often it is not. Often it's absolutely disastrous. So meditation isn't some strange Eastern mumbo jumbo. It's not something that weirdos do. We're doing it all the time if we're truly becoming skilled at something, if we're truly concentrating on something. I mean, I used to watch my mum sitting down knitting in the afternoon. There she was, meditating. I would watch my dad tinkering away in the garage. There he was, meditating, in a state of presence, in a state of calm, letting go of everything else, just simply in a state of being. Except, of course, when he whacked his finger with a hammer. But fortunately, he didn't do that too often. Now, I'm not talking here about perfection. When I'm speaking of being mindful, being in more of a state of being in the zone, on a permanent basis, if you like. I am not a perfected being, but I have learnt the art of meditation and the art of mindfulness. And I have crossed a certain threshold when it comes to self-mastery. To use the rider and the horse analogy again, I am very aware of when the horse starts to slip off the track that I have designated consciously for it. I do slip up. I do say things that I would prefer not to say, but what I am able to do is catch them quickly and come back to a present state of mind. I am able to quickly come back to a state of conscious choice, where I can see my mind and what it's doing, where I can feel what is happening, where I can observe what is going on around me, and then make another choice that is more appropriate to that situation. I can honestly say that 90% of my suffering, compared to when I began this journey at the age of 24, has fallen away. I still have a long way to go in terms of ultimate enlightenment. There is still much potential that I wish to realize within myself. There are still things within me that I can still struggle with. However, I am able to master a large part of my mind at this present time. Very few things are able to pull me off my center, and when they do, I don't stay off for long. Meditation and its counterpart of mindfulness enables me to be present and aware on an ongoing basis. So what are some basic steps that will enable us to get out of our mind in regards to meditation and into our observer self? Our conscious awareness. One of the first things we use in meditation is our own body. One advantage that our body has that our mind doesn't is our body is always here in the now. Our body can't be yesterday, it can't be tomorrow, it can't be over there, it can't be in somebody else's business. It can only be where we are now. Not so the mind. I can be sitting in this chair or in front of this microphone talking to you, but my mind may start to wander. It might start to think about the lunch that I'm going to have in a few hours. It may think about the discussion I had with my partner this morning. It may think about the deadline that I have to get this show done. My mind might start worrying about whether you will like the show or not, whether it has any use, if it's going to reach the amount of people that I wish it to reach. If this occurs, my ability to be able to perform the task right in front of me in the here and now is going to be reduced. This is the problem of the mind. Pure conscious awareness, however, does not have this problem. The power of consciousness is in the fact that it is always here, always now. It is always centered in the present moment. It is not bound by the past. It may be fully open to the future in regards to our potential, but it resides eternally in the now. And that is where the body is. So we consciously use the body like an anchor. We sort of toss it out and hook onto the present moment in order to pull ourselves just a bit free of the turbulent waters of the mind, just enough to be able to see above those waters, to be able to observe them, rather than be lost in them. Enough to know that we are not this mind, we are observing this mind. The way we do this in meditation is we focus on the breath. And we focus on the breath in some point of the body. For example, I can observe the rising and the falling of my chest, or I can observe the sensation of the breath moving in and out past the tip of my nose, or I can simply observe my breath as I'm focused at the center of my third eye, in between the eyebrows, in other words. The breath may always be moving, but it's a rhythmic circular motion, and that breath is always now. Every breath is a new now moment. When I am present and aware and focusing on my breath, I am here now, away from the constant busyness of the mind. I am not rejecting my mind. I am not trying to judge or condemn anything. I am simply stepping into the now moment, in a position where I can observe the content of my mind floating past like clouds in the sky, where I am not going to try to engage in it, react to it, or be pulled by it. Instead, my main focus will be on breathing, following my in-breath, and then noticing that there's a bit of a pause at the top, and then following my out-breath, and notice the pause at the bottom. You may wish to try that even as you are listening to the show. Try that to help you be more concentrated on my voice, on what I am saying. Be focused in your breath, observe your breath moving in and out, but this doesn't take up 100% of your concentration. Let it take up, or say, 20%, and then for the rest, simply know that you are here now, observing, experiencing what is at the focus of your intention, and that is to listen to this radio show, nothing else. The breath keeps you anchored to that intention, to this now moment, to the task at hand. Where concentration meditation is concerned, which is like the first stage of meditation, trying to bring the mind into a state of deep, profound stillness, the breath is going to be a central feature of that practice. What I wish to do is to focus only on the breath, to be literally be the breath, to be flowing with the breath, but somehow be a still point at the very center of that breath. And as I am focusing on that still point at the center of the breath, it is like the still point begins to grow. It begins to expand into a great, deep, silent field of awareness, like a void. And in this void, it is very easy to spot, to observe, to sense anything that enters. At first, of course, so much of the mind is going to just flood into this space that it's going to be hard for us to tell the difference between that point of silence, that point of concentration, and the mind as it's rushing here and there and in and out and constantly distracting us as a result. Now, even this seemingly unsatisfactory experience can be very useful. To begin with, people are quite shocked initially when they begin trying to practice meditation at how out of control their mind really is. This horse just goes wherever it likes. Our ability to control it, to command it, to steer it, is virtually nil. We are controlled by our old habits, conditioning, instincts, unconscious beliefs. We are not in conscious control of our own life. It is important to look at this positively. It's important to look at this situation and say to yourself, "Wow, I have so much room for improvement here. Just think how much my life is going to improve every little bit of control I gain back from my mind." Unfortunately, though, most people give up meditation at this point because of an unrealistic expectation that it was going to be easy, that somehow they were going to achieve this profound state of stillness and peace. And here is your first lesson in meditation. do not get attached to your expectations of what it's going to be like and how it should be. Back to the central core of non-attachment. The experience just is. It's simply an experience. So you go back to your breath and you observe some more. Ah, mind out of control. How interesting. Now back to the breath. It was actually the expectation that I should get myself into a profound state of concentration quickly that most pulled me off my center. When I can accept that my mind is unruly, when I stop condemning that, when I allow it to simply flow through me without getting hassled by that experience, the quicker I will find that stillness at the center of the breath. The experience simply is what it is. It is essential from the perspective of conscious awareness, as the observer of this experience, not to put any meaning on that experience, not to overlay some conclusion or projection onto that experience. It just simply is, mind busy with thought. Something neutral like that. That is all it is. It's a mind thinking. And right here is a deeper understanding of non-attachment. And right here also is a deeper understanding of the nature of the ego. Ego is the potential of consciousness, but it is still submerged in the mind and its conditionings and habits, fears and insecurities. It is trying to observe, it's trying to manage the experience of life, but it doesn't really know what it is. It doesn't comprehend its potential. So in this particular sort of experience, the ego got itself caught up in wanting the meditation to be a certain way, in order to perhaps prop up its self-esteem, or to escape from life's suffering in some way. The ego tends to grasp at the experience like a starving man tries to grasp at food. Rather, we need to, as conscious awareness, allow the experience to be as it is, to simply let it unfold, to observe, without putting anything on it, without judging it, condemning it, reacting to it in any way. We are just watching the mind. So within that experience of watching, as we're watching the mind, we are also watching the emotional needs of the mind. Its fear of not getting this, its expectations of getting that. Here is the endless chasing after or running away from that the mind is constantly engaged in. The attachment or aversion that is spoken of in Buddhism. Here you are observing the very seeds of suffering that the mind is caught up in. To break this nexus of suffering, we let go of the need to have something a certain way. We are even letting go of the need of having still silence in our meditation. It's an interesting paradox that the more we let go of these things, the more that silence arises. And here is another profound lesson in detachment, and that is, there is nowhere to escape. There's nothing to escape from. When you let go, allow, completely harmonize with the experience, there it is. You're beyond the experience. You have transcended that experience. You have broken free of the nexus of suffering, at least in that brief moment. You are no longer in conflict with the experience. You have in fact detached from that experience. The conditions of the experience hasn't changed. What has changed is the way you perceive the experience, the way you take it in, the way you consciously respond to it. You have just achieved something very, very powerful. With this detachment, you have put yourself in the position to make another choice, a conscious choice that may change the way you experience a similar situation. You are starting to take charge of your life. A small step, yes, but the potential is enormous. Look how much we have learnt already, just from this brief experience. We have learnt about the nature of our expectations. Expectations are fine, but do not get attached to them, because we cannot necessarily control the environment, the outcome, everything else that's going on around. We must flow with it. Projection is the same. Do not project what you think should happen on a situation. It is going to unfold. Work with it. We learned about the ego. The ego is an ability of consciousness that is not yet awake. It's trying to manage, but it's lost in the old habits, confusions of the mind. And we're learning about the emotional needs of the mind, its attachments and aversions, and the way that creates suffering in our life. And we've learned that detaching ourselves from all that chasing or running away enables us to transcend the experience, the suffering of that experience. We don't have to reject the experience or run away from the experience, but we transcend the suffering of that experience. We get into a position where we can start choosing how we consciously respond to that experience. So back to the breath, back to breathing and observing. And when we get distracted again, simply get back to the breath as soon as you're aware of that distraction, and then observe what that distraction was about. You may have forgotten what it was about, it doesn't matter. Simply get back to the breath and keep observing, noting that the mind keeps pulling you off that center. But that's okay, accept that. Don't be frustrated, just keep coming back to the breath. It is the calm abiding, it's the acceptance, it's the allowing, it's the embracing that will begin to enhance that quietness in you. It is the aversion or the chasing after, the wanting to possess, wanting to consume that is causing the suffering, not the experience itself. So try to practice just this basic technique in your everyday life. Spend short blocks of 10 minutes just sitting, breathing, observing, accepting everything that you're observing, allowing everything to flow on by, letting everything go. Simply be the breath. Observe. Free yourself from attachment to the experience. Find the peace in that, if you can. While you're out and about during the day, remember the breath. Peace is just a breath away. Stop. Breathe. Be observant. Be mindful. Am I being driven by my mind, or am I choosing in this moment? Nothing is more important than my serenity, my tranquility, my peace of mind. Think of it that way. Let it all go. Make a conscious choice. That is truly caring toward yourself without making anybody wrong. All the principles that you've been learning in the previous shows, here they are. You can apply them in that moment of conscious stillness. So this wraps up the first program on meditation, a bit like Meditation 101. Next week, we'll continue with a little bit of insight just to summarize what we've done here, but then get into some exercises in stages that will give you some real tools to use in your daily life. Be a guardian angel to yourself, and love will always warm your heart. For wisdom is intelligent love in action.